The United Astrology Congress presents this live recording from the 1992 conference held April 16th through the 21st, 1992. We take you to the Hyatt Regency in Crystal City, Virginia, where the program is just now beginning.
Refer, you can hang yourself. Anyway, okay. Where was I? Okay. So we'll be discussing, God, my voice got louder all of a sudden. We'll be discussing what an archetype is, since midlife is just a transition from one archetype to another. We shall be applying this whole concept to the United States of America, which I assert is going through a collective midlife transition. And then we'll be discussing how the astrology amplifies and expands upon these concepts and makes them easier to understand for us. So, what is an archetype? I know you've heard it 100 times at this conference, but since the basic sort of seed of this entire presentation is the comprehension of an archetype, we sort of perhaps had best start by defining it. What is an archetype? Well, you know you're dealing with an archetype when you start entering the twilight zone, you know, when things start feeling intense and powerful and out of control, when there's a sense of powerlessness, of depression, of it's what Jungians call numinosity. It's a sense that things are more significant and larger than life, that things are more powerful and significant than simply day-to-day stuff. What is an archetype? Well, an archetype is precisely a pre-existent pattern of behavior and imagination about which information organizes itself. In sort of the same way, let's say that you have a saturated solution of sugar and hot water, and it cools, sugar crystals will form in that solution. Okay, how did those little crystals know what shape they were supposed to take? They'll be little six-sided crystals. How come they aren't eight-sided crystals, or nine-sided crystals, or two-sided crystals? How come they have six sides? Because there is something in the nature of the matter of crystal and of sugar and water that it will form this particular type of crystal. It is as if the chemicals form themselves around a pre-existent pattern. Now, Plato thought that the world, that everything that you see in the world, is just a reproduction of a form, with a capital F, some idealistic form which is an absolute, which is this pattern about which experience organizes itself, about which matter and psychology organize themselves. And this concept is the reason that astrology works. Because the planets themselves are archetypes. And the planetary patterns are archetypes of energy and experience about which our lives form themselves. Now, not only do you have this form, like an archetype can be something like mother, the concept of mother, a protective feminine force, that's an archetype. Not only are there such things as archetypes, but archetypes themselves have directions toward which they move. They have destinies and concepts and directions toward which they move. So not only do you have the archetype of mother, the wise old man, evil, these concepts, these grand concepts, which link very closely with astrological planets often. Not only do you have these archetypes, but each archetype has a story toward which it moves. And often this story is told in the myth surrounding the planet. Like we know the myth of Mars and the myth of Saturn and the myth of Pluto, and their mythological characters were conceived of by the Greeks as a way of discussing the archetypes, as a way of making the archetypes seem real. Now, what have archetypes got to do with people? Well, people, of course, sometimes form themselves around archetypes in the same way that crystals form themselves into a particular shape. And we don't really know that we're doing that at the time. When we're studying astrology, we're really attempting to understand why we have formed ourselves, our lives have formed a certain pattern, have acquired a particular destiny, or to use the Aristotelian word, an entelechy, which is the object toward which a process moves. And in understanding astrology, we are attempting to understand our entelechies, the processes toward which our lives are moving us, and we're sometimes trying to say, hey, I want to get off the train. Just a moment. This is not where I want to go. A person in crisis is someone who has decided that he wants to change or she wants to change the position that he or she or toward which they are moving. Now, Carl Jung wrote about this situation. the worst thing that can happen to an individual, now when Carl Jung says the worst thing that can happen to an individual, one should pay attention. Carl Jung said, the worst thing that can happen to an individual is to identify with an archetype. That is to say, when you have gotten so tied up in some transpersonal cosmic reality, some archetype, that you are no longer in control of your life, that is the stuff of which Greek tragedy is created. That is the stuff of which the destruction of a personality comes. So, it is important to understand when an archetype has seized control of a person, and to attempt to understand what's going on when you're changing from one to another, as you do in midlife. Now, all that I've said about an individual being caught up in an archetype can also be true of a society. And when a society loses control consciously and the archetype starts unfolding, you get some really extraordinary things happening. And I think that's probably what's wrong with our society now. Now, I've got sort of a new take on this whole thing, which kind of explains the purpose of life. I'm sure that all of you are interested to hear. Having gone this far through it without really knowing just why, I suppose you'll be happy to hear at this point, and this probably reached came to this lecture. I should have called it the purpose of life. Anyway, it seems that sort of the purpose of life, in a certain Jungian way of looking at it, is the longer that you can maintain control of your life and consciously assimilate the archetypes through which you pass, not getting caught up in one of them and being taken away by the power of the archetype, the more you have lived, the more consciously you have lived. And as you try to live consciously, there's kind of this thing that you're going along this, it's like a cat walking on a fence. And when you start out, all the cats are walking along the fence. And one by one, you see your friends drop off as you go through middle age. And where do they drop off into? Well, they turn into their parents. Here is the stick. Now, the carrot is we all want to understand where we're going and why. The stick is that to fail in the midlife crisis is to fall off the fence, and all those who fall off the fence turn into their parents. Now, some of us had really nice parents, and that might be okay. How many here would be perfectly happy to turn into your parents? Well, there are a few people here for whom that's true. There's nothing wrong. No. That's perfectly okay. Some of us had perfectly fine. However, some of us, you'll notice it was not a majority that raised their hands, some of us do not think that that's the best thing that could happen to us. And so for us, there's a little more work to do, because that is the default position in the computer. If you don't do anything at midlife, you turn into your parents. All right. If you don't come to this lecture and understand what's going on in the midlife transition, you will turn into your parents. Now, don't you wish you'd brought some of your friends? It's too late for them, though, right? Just let them go. Okay, so midlife is the transformation from identification with youth to maturity. And it's a really delicate process. It's really a delicate type of thing. So let's speak for a moment of the archetype of youth, just so we get an idea of what the archetype of youth is. I have a lecture which I haven't given here, but some of you may have heard it elsewhere, called the Puer Eternus, which is Latin for eternal youth. And the Puer Eternus, or the Peter Pan, is an archetype of youth. Now, the archetype of youth is perfectly okay when you're 17 years old. That's perfectly fine, because you are a young person, so therefore you ought to act like one. And there are certain things that people act like at that age. And just very quickly going through it, there's a certain sense of irresponsibility. You don't want to grow up. There's a postponement of self-definition. You want to go as long as you can before you say, I am a something or other. You don't want to define yourself like you wish to remain free. There is an attachment to symbols which I call ascensionism, which is attachment to symbols of flying, getting high, air, rising, motion. Like, these particular things are things that young people are always attracted to. And the more you identify with the archetype of youth, the more you'll be attracted to motorcycles, fast cars, high mountains, and strong drugs, all of which make you high. Another attribute of the Puer Eternus is the Messiah complex. just because they have no power and they have no ability to functionally affect the world, they think that they are going to completely transform it. I shall transform everything in this world. My wonderful ideas, the product of my perfect consciousness, will transform the entire world, and all evil shall be banished forever from it. Every young person really believes that. Every young person says, well, just as soon as I get my handle on it, I'm going to make everything okay. We're going to save the whales. We're going to straighten out the environment. We're going to do everything. It's going to be absolutely perfect. Of course, we know that there are certain things they're not aware of that have to be overcome before this can happen, and they'll soon find out about them, won't they? Another attribute of the Puritanus is what I call sentimentality / and coldness. And the idea of that is that you can become very much attached and very emotionally attached to things as long as they're long, long away. You know, like you constantly emote over operatic sopranos or dead movie stars or people who are so far away that, you know, like the idea of the archetypal teenage girl going crazy over Sean, whatever his name is this week, who is on the screen, who she will never meet, and she has absolutely no use for any of her own contemporaries who actually are there. Okay, this is the archetype or the idea of sentimentality and coldness, which is one of the attributes of the Puritanus. Now, all these things that I've described, which I go into in great and difficult detail with in the lecture on the Puritanus, are perfectly reasonable things for a 17-year-old to act out. This is exactly what they should do. This is the archetype of youth, and this is how they should act. The problem comes when you identify with that archetype, when in creating your own identity, when you decide, who am I? Tell me who you are. Write down on this piece of paper everyone who you think you are, and you describe the archetype of youth as your identity. Now, what happens if you describe the archetype of youth as your identity and you get older? Well, clearly, at some point, this archetype of youth is no longer going to fit. And in order for you to hang on to it, you're going to have to tell more and more lies to yourself until finally you'll probably have to take some sort of medication, which they'll be happy to supply you to keep from noticing the truth that you are no longer young. The meaning of life, again, you start out in life with completely potential. You could become anything. You could become a junkie. You could become a movie star. You could become the president. You could become all three. I think we just did that, didn't we? That all of these things are potential. Those things are potential. As time passes, you must transform that potential into accomplishment, that you can no longer just be someone who's going to be something. You actually have to be these things. And finally, by the time you get to be a certain age, you have to recognize the fact that you can no longer be everything. You're too old to be a ballet dancer. You cannot be a movie star. It's too late to start training for your operatic career. And these are certain things that you simply have to acknowledge in time. The Puritanus does not. The Puritanus fixates, identifies with the archetype of youth, and thinks, I will always be young. I can always postpone these decisions. I can continue doing this forever and ever, and it'll go on, and no one will ever notice, and I will be eternally, eternally young. And if there's any problems with it, of course, there's a little plastic surgery, there's liposuction, there are vitamins, there's health food, there's all the things that I can use to make sure that I am as eternally young physically as I appear to be mentally. Now, you can see that this thing can only go for so long before it's going to crash into the wall of reality, or, as I say, that the butterfly of youth will get caught in the blades of the electric fan of reality. And the Puritanus does not surrender to age when it comes, tries to hold on to youth, and this creates a very interesting phenomenon. When you try to hold on to the archetype of youth beyond its time, it polarizes age and youth. Okay, we have described the archetype of the Puritanus. Now let us describe what happens when the archetype of youth polarizes itself with its opposite. The opposite of the Puritanus is a concept called the senex, which is the Latin word for agedness, from which we get things like senile and senator. And well, it's true. And The concept of the senex is opposite the Puritanus. Now, the Puritanus and the senex, the catch is, we think these are opposites, but actually they are identically the same thing. The Puritanus and the senex are the same archetype. turned upside down or seen in a mirror. Now, the positive manifestation of the Senex is the nurturing parent, the concept of experience, wisdom, the kindly father, this idea of the gentle, protective Saturnian figure. However, when polarized against the Pueriternus, the two of them locked in eternal battle, the negative Senex is the negative thing that we associate with a bad Saturn, grasping, cynical, cruel, not holding on to power, the myth of Saturn. After all, Uranus was a sky god, a very Pueriternus idea-based sky god who sort of floated around in the ether, right? And his kids, of course, were too earthy. He married Gaia, the earth, and the product of these were his children whom he couldn't stand because they were too earthy. So the Saturn child stayed under the earth and then finally one night attacked and castrated his father with his famous sickle. Now Saturn went on to have the same thing occur to him where his own son Jupiter overthrew him and took over. This is the way the polarized generations relate. There's no continuum. There's no handing down of power from one generation to the next. Instead, there is a constant grasping of power and a constant crisis and battling for control of the society. The two should integrate. The Puer and Senex should integrate. A youth should gain experience, and age should retire and leave youth the things that it can do as it gradually grows into power. However, in a place where the Puer and the Senex are polarized, I should write Puer on the board so you know the word, by the way, P-U-E-R, Puer Aeternus, which simply means in Latin the eternal youth. And when the Puer and the Senex are polarized, there is no easy transition. And if you've read Robert Johnson's He, when they describe the Grail Castle, or T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland, there is this a societal reality that comes into being when the Puer and the Senex are polarized. The Senex wants to die. The wounded king is in the castle. He's been wounded and he's been bleeding, but he cannot die because the youth has not come forth to overthrow him. He has a wound in his thigh. He bleeds all the time. And during this time, nothing can grow. Nothing can change. The cattle do not breed. The land gets dark. Everything turns into stone. There is misery and sorrow. The sun does not shine. And nothing can progress because everything is frozen. Everything is rigid. Everything is frozen in time. And then the youth must come and somehow free the Senex so he can die and time can continue for itself. Well, when a society is polarized in this way, as of course I think you've noticed that ours, it kind of, you know, the wasteland sounds a bit like America in 1990, especially if you're downtown anywhere. And when a society is polarized collectively, it makes it much more difficult for individuals to have a transition from youth into age because we are contained within our society as a fish is contained within the river, and if the river is frozen, it is hard for us to swim up or downstream. And so you can see that how the crisis of our individual midlife transitions is collectively parallel to the crisis of our society and its wasteland. So let us speak of the transition. What can happen when an individual tries to move from Puer Aeternus to Senex and from Senex to Puer Aeternus? Okay, there are two halves of life. And in youth, one is, of course, in the first half. And in the first half of life, everything seems to be getting bigger and better and more. I mean, as you grow, you get more, you get better, you are become more competent. You're able to, well, you choose a persona, you know, you pick out a little sort of self and say, okay, I'm going to be an astrologer. And the longer you are an astrologer, the better you get. And you think, gee, this is great. The longer I do this, the better I get. This is really neat. And so you keep doing it. The same is true of identifying with the archetype of youth. You say, okay, I am this person, I am this Puer Aeternus. The longer I do it, the better I can do it. Now I'm really good at it. However, as Carl Jung says, and I will quote, in the midlife transition, this is what happens. The basic cause of all the difficulties of this transition is to be found in a deep-seated and peculiar change within the psyche. In order to characterize it, I must take for comparison the daily course of the sun. but a son that is endowed with human feeling and man's limited consciousness. I presume he meant women, too. In the morning, it rises from the nocturnal sea of unconsciousness and looks upon the wide, bright world which lies before it in an expanse that steadily widens the higher it climbs in the firmament. In this extension of its field of action caused by its own rising, the sun will discover its significance. It will see the attainment of the greatest possible height and the widest possible dissemination of its blessings as its goal. In this conviction, the sun pursues its course to the unforeseen zenith. Unforeseen because its career is unique and individual, and the culminating point could not have been calculated in advance. At the stroke of noon, the descent begins. And the descent means the reversal of all the ideals and values that were cherished in the morning. The sun falls into contradiction with itself. It is as though it should draw in its rays instead of emitting them. Light and warmth decline and are at last extinguished. So you have to realize that when the sun is rising, it can only think it will go up forever. There's no way you can tell it, okay, you're going to reach a point and then you're going to start going down. But you do. You reach this midlife point, at which point life reverses its directions. And this is the transition from the archetype of youth to the archetype of maturity. Now, the Greeks were real good at collective psychology. Instead of having therapists to which only the privileged could go, which is our way of handling the issue, which I think will be shown is not a very good one, since mostly the privileged don't really need them that badly. Instead of having that, they had theater, which took these archetypes and acted them out in epics. And I think the Odyssey is the epic of the midlife transition. It is the Odyssey that is the epic or the symbol of the midlife transition. And so we will see certain parallels between the concept of Odysseus going across the sea and the transition to which an individual has to go through at the time when they're going through their midlife crisis. So there's a book, by the way, which I drew much of this idea from. It's called In Midlife by Murray Stein. And it was published by Spring in 1983, and it's a really interesting way to view all of these transitions. Anyway, the first thing that happens in what he sees as the paradigm of the midlife transition is what he calls separation. And separation, these stages are not discrete and individual stages. It isn't like, well, first you go through separation, and then you go through this, and then you go through that. Some of them, but they actually sort of blur in with each other. But let me write the three stages down here, and we'll briefly go through each one. The first stage of the midlife transition is separation. And what's meant by separation is that you separate from your youthful identity, that this archetype of the puerternus that you have been identifying with all this time has to be separated from. What happens is that the mask of adolescence that you have worn, this persona that you have acquired, suddenly cracks, and you suddenly see that it has become a lie. After all, when you were young, when you were like in your teenage years, you selected a persona. You had all these possible personas, like you could have been, like for instance, in high schools now, you can be a junkie or you can be a jock. And, like you might even try junkie first, right? You say, well, that looks like more fun. So you try doing this and you try doing that, and yet it doesn't seem like you see sort of that that's not really. So then you try this persona. You say, well, maybe I can be a jock. And so you try that one. And, well, you don't quite have the build for it or something, so that one doesn't work. You aren't quite coordinated enough. So you try on different personas. And finally, at some time, you say, well, this mask isn't quite right, but I've really got to pick one because, if I don't have a mask on, they can see who I am. So you take this mask and you put it on, and it sort of grows into your face like a science fiction movie, and there you are. Now, 30 years later, here you are with this mask that you stuck on your face. It wasn't quite right, but all of a sudden, a crack forms in it. All of a sudden, this mask, which didn't really quite fit right the first time, cracks. And something happens in your reality, because actually probably the main reason that it cracks is because you're getting old. Like, as your body changes, as the concept of yourself as indicated by your body The persona is a brittle mask, and as you change, it cracks, and it begins to break open. And of course, you defend it intensely at first, and you try to stick it back together and use scotch tape and liposuction, plastic surgery, and anything else you can get to try to stick it back together again. But basically, you know it was a lie to start with, you know it's a lie now, and something inside you demands that you go a bit further. Now, of course, you can do one of two things at separation. You could either accept it and say, okay, the persona, this whole identity that I've been working on 20 years to create is a lie, and I must discard it. This is not an easy thing to do. This is like taking all the things you have, putting them in your house, setting the house on fire, and walking away. It is not an easy thing to do. So this persona must be sacrificed. If not, you can try to stick it back together again. This is what the Jungians call defensive restructuring. And there actually are therapists who will help you and say, oh, yes, well, let's stick it back together again now. Let's just try to see. Yes, of course, there'll be a few bruises here. We're not going to get this cheekbone quite right, but let's stick it back together again and see what we can do. This way madness lies. This is not what you should do because you will turn into your parents. As I have said all along here, any failure at any of these stages of midlife, the penalty is to turn into your parents. Because you will end up defending that rigid image of yourself. Oh, you don't have to turn right into your parents. You can also turn into their shadows. In fact, that's what you usually do. You know, the opposite of what they are. But that's just the same. You're still not yourself. You're still turning into either your parents or the opposite of them. Both are equally bad because this crack has formed in your persona. And if you stick it back together again, you're going to be spending so much time sticking yourself back together again that you will only be able to act habitually and you will turn into your parents. So, it may be patched up, but it's never quite the same. The phase will come to an end when you acknowledge that your persona will no longer work and that something new will have to be developed. The big question is, of course, what? You then enter upon the stage of midlife that we call, or that I call, liminality. Liminality is a word that I got from Murray Stein, and what it means is it comes from the Greek word limnos, which means a borderline or a shoreline. And liminality is that stage of being in sort of betweenness, the stage of being in between. And at this point, what's happened is your ego, you know, your sense of identity, your personality is weaker. Because this persona is just sort of falling apart, right? And you're saying, well, gee, who am I? Because your ego is weaker, a lot of things start creeping up from the basement. Do you know what I mean, creeping up from the basement? Some of these options that you did not choose to do in adolescence, you know, like the junkie and the jock and the other little options that you did not select, some of them start creeping up the stairs from the basement because the lock on the basement door has been weakened by the fact that you're busy dealing with the fact that your persona is cracking to pieces. So every once in a while, weird compulsions will surface. Strange compulsions will occur during your 40s that ask you to do things that are things that are roads left untraveled, things that you did not do when you were younger. Some of these can be quite extraordinary. I mean, some of these can be really unusual things. Like, for instance, most of you, I suppose, have related to the opposite sex, usually, during your lifetime. Well, now, there was an option back there when you were 15 years old to relate to the same sex sexually, maybe. And you put that one in the cellar, deep in the cellar. I mean, you nailed that door shut. Well, it's still in there, and that still is an option. And in dreams, in fantasy, or sometimes in reality, that particular reality might say, hey, since your persona's not working, why don't you try me for a while? There are other things that come up like that. All the things that you have been, their opposites will be the strongest things that insist attention. Now, it doesn't mean you have to do these things, although perhaps you might. However, it does mean that they are demanding attention. It means that all of this identity that you have created for yourself is being severely questioned, completely questioned and reassessed, and you must allow it to be questioned. If at any time you close the door and say, I will not entertain that possibility, you will turn into your parents. This is called the return of the repressed, by the way. And in fact, the novel Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is a lot about the Victorian horror of the return of the repressed, where the Victorians say, oh my God, if it ever gets out of the closet, it will stomp through the world and do great evil. Well, that's, of course, they didn't really quite have a concept of integrating the self. This was not a Victorian ideal. integrating the self was not. So anyway, if you get some dreams about leather or you're, you know, a bit of rubber or something like that, I mean, you know, it's probably okay to entertain these possibilities because these are parts. And from actually, Stein tells a story that perhaps can make this a bit more constructive. He tells a story of this housewife who suddenly, at the age of 40, she was, you know, upper middle class housewife, doyen of society type, and all of a sudden she'd go into department stores and uncontrollably be seized by the desire to shoplift cosmetics. And here's this, you know, terribly proud, silver-haired, you know, stashing lipsticks in her purse. And why was she doing this? What was going on? She was terrified. She went to the Stein, who's an analyst, and said, "Look, I'm stealing all these cosmetics. What if I get caught? What will the neighbors say?" This is really far out. What is going on here? This is a compulsion she cannot understand. This is one of the things that was locked in the closet of, in the basement of her youth. This was her attempt to be a beautiful sex object. And she could have been that. Instead, she married the MBA and did all the right stuff, right? So this was her desire to be a beautiful sex object, cosmetics, a symbol of her Venus, demanding attention, demanding that she spend some time being her Venus. So as soon as she was told that, she could go and try to become an artist or something, you know, a part-time artist or something like that. She could give her Venus the recognition that it deserved. So when these repressed things start knocking on the floor from the basement saying, "Hey, we want some time," you shouldn't simply put new locks on the basement door. Instead, you should ask, "What is this telling me that I must do in order to become whole?" So like her, you should say, "Why am I stealing cosmetics?" instead of saying, "Me? I'm not stealing cosmetics." Something else that goes on during this period is the battles with the parents. And this is not necessarily an outward battle with your parents. It is the battle with the concept of your parents. Your relationship with your mother is the deepest relationship you are ever going to have with anybody. Let's just start with that basic reality. You are never going to be inside anyone else's stomach. This is absolutely guaranteed. Who will take care of you and nurture you completely and totally for 9 months and then for several years after that. So clearly the relationship with the mother, but in order to be a grown-up, you have to sort of transcend that relationship. You have to go a bit beyond that. And so you must, as the Jungians say, quote, kill, unquote, the mother. This does not mean that you take an axe to the deer. It means that instead you transcend the fact that she has been this powerful relationship. And what happens is if you can turn your mother into a person instead of an archetype, if you can de-archetypalize her, if you can take all the power from her as a person, then she becomes just another person, and this enables you to relate to other people in a way you never have before. This allows you a deep and mature relationship with other people. The penalty, if you do not de-archetypalize your mother, you will turn into her. Or you'll marry her, one or the other, or you will remain married to her, more likely, which is what you probably did in the first place. So that the whole business of the midlife affair, you know, that the weird sexual things that people do at midlife, the concept of the Blue Angel, that amazing movie with you know, 1930 movie where this German professor is completely obsessed with a showgirl and destroys himself absolutely and horribly because of his obsession. What lies behind that whole thing is the concept of you must deal with this archetype or it will destroy you. That is what all this is saying. Then when you're through with mother, you can approach father. The reward for turning your mother into another person, just another person with whom you can relate, is that you can then therefore relate really to other people on a one-to-one basis. Now, the father is the transmitter of social values, and this is really important because this is what sort of leads us to the present situation that our society is in. If you can get rid of the father, if you can overcome your father, overwhelm him in some way, then it sort of breaks down the battle of the puer and the senex. When the father is in control of everything, everything gets transmitted in a rigid and unchanging way, and society remains a wasteland. So unless the father is taken away from, unless the father's power is taken away from him, he remains a senex, and you remain the puer, and society remains eternally polarized. This is what is wrong with America at this time. is that people have not overwhelmed, have not turned their fathers into people. They are still minding what daddy says, not voting or voting Republican. What happens is that these are battles of the soul, and they sound, and these are things that happen during liminality, during this period after you have said, okay, I have broken away from my persona of a youth, and these are some of the ghosts and monsters, just some, I mean, there's a whole list. So these are some of the ghosts and monsters that come up upon you. And if you fail in any of these tests, I've already told you what the penalty is. In fact, I found a greeting card, which I bought all of them that I could get because I send them to all my friends. It shows this sort of distraught-looking woman in a 1950 movie, sort of in a strange little pillbox hat, and she's sitting at the doctor's desk looking, you know, terribly upset. And there's the doctor sitting behind the desk looking very grave and fatherly. And the caption is, "She told herself she was just feeling tired, not up to those late nights. Then her doctor confirmed her worst suspicions." And she's saying, "You mean, gasp, I'm turning into my parents." The doctor's saying, "Yes, I'm afraid so, my dear. You'll slowly begin to lose your sense of humor and develop a fondness for Lawrence Welk." It's a birthday card. It says inside, "Happy birthday." So this is kind of what this is all about. And if you wish to remain individuated, if you wish to embark upon what Jung calls the path of individuation, which is becoming yourself, then these are things that you cannot do. These are battles that you must engage in order to free yourself from the past. Now, after you wander around in liminality and deal with mother and father in various different forms and guises, at some point in the midlife transition is the journey to Hades. And the journey to Hades is kind of the crucial and critical point. The Odyssey, when he gets furthest from home, you know, he's trying to get back home, that is, to wholeness. And the furthest point that he gets from wholeness is when he sets sail and goes to Hades. He goes to Hades and there meets with Tiresias, who is this wise old man, who gives him certain advice which allows him to get home. So you have to go to Hades in the midlife transition in order to get home. That's what this epic is trying to tell us. What does going to Hades mean? It means acknowledging death. Now, all of us know we're going to die. Nobody here thinks that an exception is going to be made in his or her case. However, we all really do, don't we? We really think, well, of course I'm going to die, but it isn't going to be anytime soon, and I really don't have to think about it. One of the perhaps most difficult part of the midlife transition is the absolute acceptance of death. And that is the acceptance of a reality that you can do nothing about. That is accepting that something is going to happen to you that you have no control over, that you are going to die, that your will is going to be finally overcome. And that is not a happy thing to acknowledge. It's not a happy thing to feel. But it must be acknowledged in order to move on beyond the midlife transition. Again, if you're afraid to make the journey to Hades, you can only go backwards. And if you can only go backwards, we already know what that means. So you must accept death as a reality. And that is, once you have done that, Tiresias, the wise old man, gives you three pieces of advice. And this is out of the Odyssey. The first thing he says is, on your way back to Ithaca, you will land on an island populated by the holy cattle of Apollo. Don't mess with the holy cattle of Apollo, right? Once you get home, you'll find that your house has been taken over by these suitors. Remember the suitors who were wooing his wife and trying to get his estates and all that? Okay, you have to clean up your own house. And finally, I'll save the last one for last. The first two basically mean, don't mess with the cattle of Apollo, basically means acknowledge what is holy in the world. Acknowledge that there are some things, that there are some laws that must be obeyed in the world, such as the environment, for instance. That would be a good one to start with. Cleaning up your house and dealing with the suitors means that you have to take control of your own life. Like you've been wandering around in liminality for 10 years, going through your midlife crisis, and things have probably fallen apart. So you have to straighten out your own house. You have to overthrow greedy people who have taken advantage of your absence. Finally, they say, take an oar like you row a boat with, inland, and plant it someplace where no one's ever seen an oar before, and there build a temple to Poseidon. Now, what on earth does he mean by that? By that he means, take the symbol of the thing that has been persecuting you. In the case of Odysseus, it was the fact that he was floating around the ocean for 10 years. Take that to a place where they don't know anything about it, and there build a temple to it. There acknowledge it. Take this knowledge of yourself and share it with other people, is how this is interpreted. And then you'll get home to Ithaca and yourself. Well, we'll bring all these threads together a bit further along, but let's just briefly get into the astrology of the midlife transition and see if any of that, I suppose you were wondering when I was going to get to the astrology, and then wonder if it ever has anything to do with anything. Now, what are the aspects that happen during the midlife transition? Uranus opposite Uranus occurs about the age of 37, and Pluto square Pluto occurs at what age? About, well, it actually depends. It's about 38, 39 now, isn't it? Or 40. Neptune square Neptune, and there's one more. Saturn opposite Saturn. Okay. Now, isn't it amazing how the four aspects, all of which involve extrapersonal planets, all of them relate exactly to these stages of the midlife transition. Uranus opposite Uranus is clearly the separation of yourself from your persona. This is when the crack in your persona occurs, and you suddenly see, probably because of an event or something, that you are not who you have pretended to be. Neptune square Neptune is certainly perfect for liminality. In fact, even the symbol of the Odyssey floating around on the sea, pursued by the sea god Poseidon, is just absolutely perfect because Poseidon is simply the Greek name for Neptune. Saturn opposite Saturn, to me, sounds like the battle with your parents. You are trying to become an authority in yourself, and you are battling Saturn. You are battling the Senex. You are battling your own Senex in that way. And Pluto square Pluto, how perfect for the journey to Hades. So what all of this means is that the psychological archetypes are simply perfectly informed by the astrological archetypes, which, of course, will come as no surprise to anyone in this room. Let's see if there's anything more particular about these that I can mention. Now, these, of course, don't always occur at exactly the same time that they're supposed to. By the way, the Neptune square Neptune occurs about the age of 42. It's quite regular because Neptune has a circular orbit. Saturn opposite Saturn occurs about the age of 44 for our current generation. This is the last one that comes. And Pluto square Pluto is now between 39 and 40. So all these occur within a very short period of time. To describe a bit more about each of the stages, separation, I think, is pretty clear. That's when your identity, especially... Now, Uranus is the identity of the Puer-Eternus. And so if you have been strongly identified with a Puer-Eternus, when you had Uranus opposite Uranus, you probably did something pretty spectacularly far out. Neptune square Neptune is the aspect that's most difficult for men. Because men are accustomed to being in control, right? And the idea that you're going to drift around with no direction and no place to go is just intolerable to a male ego. Pluto square Pluto is hard for everyone. And what's, of course, most extraordinary about Pluto square Pluto is that, I guess you know that when Carl Jung was born, which was not that long ago, 1875, he had his Pluto square Pluto at the age of 78.
What?
That is how different the orbit of Pluto can be. Our generation is special. We have such a hellish midlife transition because our generation is the only one in 250 years that will have its Pluto square Pluto at the same time it has these other aspects. Carl Jung had his at the age of 78, and that's how widely varied it can be. Even a person who's born in 1931 would have it at age 50, at least a few years away from all of these others. So that we're it. Aren't we lucky? We get to have Pluto square Pluto. Now, That's, of course, often at that time, or maybe at that time, one of your parents will die. Now, you think if your parent dies, especially your father, this means that the battle with them is over, right? Wrong. No, it means the battle has just begun. Because, of course, the real battle with your father or the battle with the parent is not to be completely absorbed by their identity. If they're no longer there to act out that identity for you, then the temptation is greatest to take it upon yourself. I have literally seen, and it was really weird, and it was one of the things that put me on this sort of trying to understand this, I have literally seen at a funeral of someone's father how he accidentally went into the closet and took his father's hat and put his father's hat on and came out to all the people who were at the funeral. I mean, what a thing to do. At the funeral, you know, he was simply saying, well, okay, it's time for me to start wearing my father's hat. And he immediately turned into his father. Well, he always had been. But at this point, he didn't have to compete with him for it. He had simply turned into his father, and that was the end of his life. I mean, especially since his father was an alcoholic, that was the end of that. So, this is all kind of amusing to talk about, but often when you take on your parents' scripts, it's because they're so intense and so powerful that they sort of had to hand them down to you. They couldn't deal with them themselves, and so you're stuck with them, and they aren't usually very happy. After all, Carl Jung said, what? The worst thing that can happen to an individual is to identify with an archetype, and that includes being possessed by the ghosts of your parents. So, there's one more aspect of the midlife transition which I think is important, which is one that I've sort of invented. It's an astrological one, and it's called, I call it, the precipitating crisis. And the precipitating crisis is the time that you realize this is going on. This is obviously a process. It maybe begins around the age of 37 and goes at least until 45, and perhaps a great deal longer than that. And sometime you're going to realize that this whole process in some way is going on. And this is what I call the precipitating crisis, when you realize that this is not just another... You know, what's really interesting about the midlife crisis is that everyone you say, you talk to about it, especially men, say, oh, well, I've already gone through that. Right? I suppose some of you have already thought, oh, well, I don't have to worry about this because I've already been through that. You haven't. You have, until you have gone through these stages identifiably, until you have gone through these torments, you have not been through it. And there's some point when you realize that this particular crisis you're going through now, this is the big one. And that seems to be when Uranus in transit aspects the sun. When Uranus aspects the natal sun or sometimes moon. And that's by square, conjunction, or opposition, or semi-square, or sesquiquadrant. And when that happens is usually when these issues come into conscious awareness, when you become totally dominated by these concepts and have to deal with them in a very powerful way. This is when the crack forms in a thing and all of this stuff comes running out to be observed. Now, if you are a Cancer or a Capricorn, what's happening to you these days? If you're sort of in the middle of the sign Cancer or Capricorn, or to a lesser degree Aries or Libra, what's happening to you? You're getting Uranus, Neptune, and the precipitating crisis all at once. For instance, if you're born on, say, July 4th, for instance. Interesting. There he is. Well, let's see. How would it look for a national midlife crisis? Let's just say, I guess I've sort of let the cat out of the bag here, haven't I? And what I'm really getting at is not only are each of us in the baby boom generation going through our midlife crises right now, but since we are the largest generation in the history of the country, we are dragging it along with us, kicking and screaming. Yes, a country has a persona just like a person does. And what's the persona of the United States like? I mean, if you were, Sweden and Austria at a party talking about the United States over your fine white wine, what would you say about the personality of the United States as a personality? Well, youthful, arrogant, clever, naive. Quereternus, getting a little bit of a bully in his old age, isn't he? He's dressing like a teenager. Look at him. I mean, he's just acting like an absolute fool. Doesn't he realize that he's getting old? So anyway, our image of the nation. Okay, now we, of course, are the richest. We still are the richest, the most just, the most equally minded, the most egalitarian, the most democratic nation on earth, aren't we? Vote. All in favor? Okay, well, there's a few people who think we still are. I suggest you go to downtown Washington and ask those people who are sleeping in the park if we're still the kindest to our poor. Let's face it, our persona is cracking. There is something wrong with our self-image. There is separation going on with our self-image. Who is? Well, okay, I didn't say who isn't or who isn't, but I'm saying that our image of ourselves as being the greatest, the biggest, the strongest, the richest, the kindest to our poor is simply no longer working. Now, whether or not someone else is doing it better, as they say, like, democracy is the worst form of government in the world except for all the rest. And I think that's probably pretty accurate. I mean, I'm not trying to say that there's any better way of doing it, but I am pleased saying that our persona of the 1776 savior of the world is cracking and falling in pieces, and most of us are not accepting it. How about liminality? Are there little pieces of ourselves from our basement coming up? Like, you know, what's the opposite of the world savior? The world bully. You know, like, you know, Grenada, Nicaragua, Libya, da-da-da. I mean, this is one a year, right? Where we've gotten to one a year, and they're actually sort of accelerating in intensity. Then, of course, there's the battle of the sexes. You can ask the Supreme Court about that. You know, are we or are we not going to treat our mother as an equal person, or are we going to try to keep her in chains? There's the extreme polarization of the prayer and the cenex. After all, I mean, really, Congress? Come on. I mean, how many congressmen can you afford to buy? I can't afford very many. And then finally, is anyone who thinks that there's not separation and liminality going on a collective level in the identity of the U.S.? And the journey to Hades, you don't?
No, I would ask you if you would say something about, distrust of Clinton, who represents...
Oh, okay, well, if we can't get into he's certainly a scientist. We all know what he is. I mean, we just have to look at the guy in his chart, Mars conjunct Neptune, to see exactly what's going on here, and we know we're being lied to. We're being lied to again. We can choose one liar or another. Great, what a choice, right? Now, the journey to Hades, have we done the journey to Hades? Now let's say that in the American psyche, there are three things that nobody ever likes to talk about. After all, we're a nice Puritan country, and we just don't like to talk about certain things. Death, sex, and toilet functions, right? Those are the three things we don't like to talk about, right? Okay, so what comes along? What has come along to get us to talk about death, sex, and toilet functions? AIDS. Ah. In fact, AIDS, I mean, what does the word... Do you know what the Greek word for Hades is actually... The Greek word for Hades, if you transliterate it into English, is AIDES. That is exactly how you spell it. Alpha, E, Delta, Epsilon, Sigma is a transliteration. It is almost the exact same word. There's an aspiration which gives it the H sign. So the actual journey to Hades is a journey to AIDS. I mean, it is so exact that it really sort of makes you feel a little weird about it. If you didn't like that one, then of course you can always have the war in Iraq. I mean, that's certainly a journey to Hades. It's just absolutely amazing. I mean, especially since the Pluto in the U.S. chart, any chart you use, really, the Lines chart, the Boyd chart, all the charts that I like, all have their Pluto lines going through the Middle East. So, I mean, like, if you needed confirmation, if you don't like AIDS as a journey to Hades, then you can also go to Iraq, where we're probably going back again. Anyway, I think everyone would agree that there's a good argument to be made that we're going through this pattern of the midlife crisis for the U.S. Now, how about the astrological aspects? Well, it just so happens that three times in the history of the U.S. have all four of those astrological aspects occurred at approximately the same time. Three times in the history of the U.S. The first time is 1850 to 1860. All three of those aspects occurred. That was the first midlife crisis of the U.S., and of course we followed it immediately with what? The Civil War. That was a good way to sort of blow off the midlife crisis, right? Anything but face the truth. Let's go have a war. The next one was, you'll not be surprised to hear, 1938 to 1942. Uranus opposite Uranus. Neptune square Neptune. Saturn opposite Saturn. And Pluto square Pluto. And I don't mean these necessary aspects, but a hard aspect, a conjunction, opposition, or square of these planets to these planets have occurred three times in American history. Once is 1850 to 1860. The next time is 1938 to 1942. Well, we had a great party after that one, didn't we? In fact, the precipitating crisis aspect of Uranus, which in this case was a semi-square, the U.S. Sun, occurred in November 1941. So that precipitated that entire midlife crisis, which culminated in the Second World War. The last series of aspects was 1981 to 1983. So have I made my argument that, in fact, I am saying that the U.S. is going through a midlife transition. We have seen how the patterns fit, and we see that, in addition, only three times in 220 years have all of these aspects occurred at the same time, and the last one was 10 years ago. In 1981. The precipitating crisis aspect, by the way, was when Uranus opposed the Sun, which was in March 1991. In 1991, we had the Persian Gulf War. remember? Oh, yeah. 81 to 83, I said that these things do not manifest. As you see, these all always occur before the crisis. The series of midlife aspects occur before it's recognized as such. In this case, 10 years before. In this case, 5 years before. In this case, 10 years before. And when Uranus makes an aspect, a hard aspect to the Sun, that is when it comes to consciousness. And Uranus opposed the U.S. Sun, this is July 4, 1776, in March 1991, exactly during the Persian Gulf War. It can come before, and that's a good question. In the case of Carl Jung, it came a little bit before. His separation with Freud, which was his major break with himself, occurred a couple of years before these aspects did. So it can occur a couple of years before. It just did, 1991. In 1991, which was the Persian Gulf War. So, by the way, I don't think I brought it. I didn't bring it, so I can't. Yes, I did. There's another interesting argument that suggests that there might be some correlation between the U.S. at this point and midlife. And what I did was I said, well, let's just play a little game here, and let's say that the beginning of Anglo-American civilization on this continent was 1607. That was the Jamestown settlement. Let's say that that is age zero for our society in this place. Let's just say that 1993 or 91, whatever, is age 43. Let's just say that we are in our midlife crisis right now at age 43. This means that, 386 years, equals 43 years. You divide it out, you get a ratio of 9 to 1. That is, if you go 1607 to 1991, 0 to 43, you end up with a ratio of 9 to 1. If you continue this to important dates in history, you get some interesting stuff. 1776 then becomes 19. We're like a 19-year-old kid. 1789, our Constitution is age 20. 1865, the Civil War, is age 29, which, of course, you'll notice as the Saturn return. 1914 is age 34. That's the First World War. 1965 is age 40, the beginning of the, you know, of the midlife crisis. 1982 is 42, and 1991 is 43. I think that's pretty interesting. I mean, I think that's really kind of interesting. It almost makes a whole pattern of a growing up person maturing at somehow 9 to 1. I have no idea why it would be 9 to 1, but that's what it seems to be. Well, that's probably what it seems. The baby boom is the largest group, So that the point is that this largest group of people are all going through their midlife crisis at the same time, and in a society that's at the same time. Now, what does all of this mean? What is the point? Well, let's see. Before we go that, let's just say, are we the only country that you can do this kind of thing with? Well, Canada was born in 1867. And because they were born in 1867, they are having their midlife series of crisis, their midlife aspect right now at the same time. And as you've heard, they're falling apart. Their constitution is about to dissolve, and Quebec is about to go off on its own. And they're all being very calm about it, but they're actually facing very much the same thing that we did in our first midlife crisis series of aspects. Israel was born in 1948, and we don't have to ask if they're having a crisis over there. China was born in 1949. Now, they're happy to turn into their parents. They want to turn into their parents. They are having a midlife crisis only because they're trying to hold on. But we know they already just had an almost rebellion in Tiananmen Square, and they will probably have another. I am saying that because they are after Israel, that they will have their rebellion somewhat later. So anyway, what is going on here? It's kind of like the polarization. Now, this is what I'm trying to say occurs in a society as time goes on. The polarization between Puer and Senex builds up to a certain point. The archetype of youth and age become separated to a point of incredible tension, and then there's a war. I mean, that's what we've seen has occurred three times before, right? We have seen that in the Civil War and the Second World War and the Persian Gulf War, that the tension builds up to a point where the Puer and Senex are perfectly polarized and totally out of touch with each other, and then there's a war. Why would there be a war? What happens in a war? Can anyone see the reason there'd have to be a war at that time? The old men send the young men off to die. Exactly. The Puer is murdered by the Senex. The old men send the young men off to die. The ones who come back have been so hideously traumatized that when they get old, they're going to turn into their parents and vote for big defense budgets, and the same cycle can go again and again and again. It's kind of like the ancient European custom of taking the king, the young king, the springtime king, and killing him and burying the pieces in the field so that the crops will come up each year. It is the ancient ritual of killing the youth in order that the aged can maintain their power. Now, if nothing changes, we can do this again and again and again. The next series of midlife aspects occurs between 2021 and 2027. So we can simply wait and do it all over again. And that, I'm afraid, is what it looks like might happen. Is there any other possible outcome? Is there anything that can be done to keep this from happening? Well, there's really a double polarization going on here. There are several possible things. First of all, over here you have the Puer and Senex group of people. These are the people who are playing the Puer and Senex game. They're going to be youthful. They're going to fight the Senex. I mean, you know, I used to think that hippies were really far out because they were standing up to the Senex. They were being the Puer. They were fighting the evil, you know, the evil Senex. But they're the same thing. They're exactly the same thing. The Puer and the Senex are simply different sides of the same thing. So over here we have these people who are on the Puer and Senex polarization bandwagon. And what they say is, life is great, the Puer will always battle the Senex, youth will always battle age, and then when there's a certain amount of tension and we can't stand it anymore, we'll have a war, kill a whole bunch of people, and start all over again. Okay, that's certainly one group of people. The other group of people, I have a name for them. I call them Odysseans. And these are people who have made the midlife odyssey. These are people who have gone through the midlife transition, who have incorporated the Puer and the Senex into one concept. They are the Odysseans who have gone through the midlife crisis and have not turned into their parents. They are the ones who have withstood all the trials on the seas of liminality, who with Odysseus has sailed through Scylla and Charybdis and gone to Hades and been blown about the wine dark sea, and they have managed to keep faith with themselves and be themselves and have not turned into their parents. There are three possible outcomes for the midlife transition. One is crash and burn. Second is rigidify and turn into your parents. And the third is somehow incorporate the concepts of Puer and Senex into the same identity. Somehow keep the child within the adult, somehow allow the creative child, the puerperus, to continue to live inside a mature person as the creative origin of a conscious life. Whoa, heavy duty. And it isn't easy, and not a lot of people are going to be able to do it, because the temptation to fall off the fence into one of the others is just too difficult. Jungians call this individuation, and other people call it other things, and there's all sorts of names for it. But anyone who can survive the Odyssey without turning into their parents is the hero. And what did Odysseus do when he got back? When Odysseus got back to Ithaca, what did he do in order to prove that he was a bona fide, that he really had survived his Odyssey? What did he have to do? Well, he killed the suitors, right? Like, remember that weird thing? There are all these suitors who had been courting his wife and his money, and he came in and he slaughtered them all. Now, what on earth does this mean something for us? What does it mean? Who might the suitors be in American society? Who are the entities that use up everything, that waste the sheep flocks, that drink up all the wine, that poison the environment, that do nothing, that give nothing back and take? The corporations and the government. Yeah, these are the suitors. These are the suitors. These are the people who have taken over the house. In the hero's absence, while Odysseus has been off on his midlife transition, these people have come in and stolen everything in the house and are living off of the land and destroying and wasting it. Where is Odysseus?
In liminality.
Well, where is he? Does anyone remember the Odyssey well enough to know? This is really going to blow your mind. Does anyone remember the Odyssey well enough to remember what happened, how Odysseus gained access to his house when he got back?
Disguised as a
homeless beggar. His dog recognized him, disguised as a homeless beggar. Who are the homeless? One-third of them are Vietnam veterans. 20 years ago, they sailed away to Troy, and now they have returned and are waiting in the house for the time to overthrow the suitors. When you don't remember, you probably don't remember, when is it that Odysseus declares himself? When is it that Odysseus declares himself? You probably don't remember. It's when his son, who the suitors have been trying to ambush and get rid of because he's, you know, causing a bit of a problem, it's when his son shows up and he declares himself to his son. Who might be the sons of the Vietnam homeless? The Persian Gulf homeless. So Telemachus, which is the name of the son, has just come back from the Persian Gulf and is meeting up with Odysseus at this very moment. And I suppose we shall have to see what happens. One more little thing. Back on the wars, remember the post-midlife wars? We had what? The Civil War and we had the Second World War. The kings who led us in those wars, Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt, what happened to them after the war?
Yeah.
Both of them died. King Agamemnon came home from Troy and was murdered. That's three. That's three out of four. Okay. So, anyway, let's just kind of see what is going on. I guess the answer to all this is that those of us in the baby boom are going through our midlife transitions. We can either assimilate the archetype of our midlife transition, or we can turn into our parents, right? And really, those are just about the only two options. Those of us who take the high road to individuation might be able to lead the country collectively into a different state of consciousness. Because when any one person consciously goes through this assimilation, this mixing of the archetype of Puer and Senex, when any one person is able to accomplish a conscious midlife transition and become an Odyssean, that reverberates in the society. Clearly, nothing is happening in the society now. The Puer and Senex are hopelessly polarized, and there's just no, the land is in chaos and wasteland. But every one of us who is able to consciously go through his or her midlife transition to incorporate the Puer and the Senex is sending out a vibration of healing to the entire society that perhaps can constellate, can bring into being Odysseus, who will then realize that the time is right for overthrowing the suitors. Are there any questions?
When do we start?
I'm not completely clear on the difference between the negative side of identifying with an archetype and what you're saying is the crucial assimilation.
Okay, the difference between the negative side of identifying with an archetype and assimilation is simply consciousness. If the archetype is running you, then it's negative. The archetype will manifest in its negative form if you are hopelessly involved in it and cannot separate from it. If you have put the water and fire together, the prayer and the senex, and incorporated them consciously by going through the stages of initiation that I've described in this outline of the midlife transition, then the archetypes are under your control. Well, not under your control, but you are conscious and therefore not subject to being carried along by the collective madness that all of us are a part of. That's as close as I can answer that question. Yes? No, he gained entrance to his house disguised as a homeless beggar. Well, we now have a lot of homeless beggars. Okay, well, that's your, of course, you can think that. Yes, I don't mean to say that one particular person who is presently a homeless beggar is going to become Odysseus and conquer the country. I don't mean that. I don't mean that at all. You're absolutely right in asking that. I don't mean that at all. I mean that there's a part of us. There's a collective part of us that is homeless beggar. It has to do with the part of us that went to Vietnam and has never been assimilated. And that is what we must deal with. It isn't an individual that's going to do this. It's each of us collectively that must assume this identity, that must own this part of ourselves. But at the same time, the real homeless, those people who have been completely rejected by our society, are the symbols of our individual rejection of those parts of ourselves. And as long as those people are out there, we have not succeeded in assimilating those archetypes. That's what I mean. Yes?
Maybe a good way to look at it might be, is when a person is without a country, within a country, a lot of us that might be homeless in that aspect, we don't feel like we're part of this place.
Yes.
From a certain standpoint. Mm-hmm. And that's the homelessness that we might feel.
Yes, he says that when we are homeless in our own country, that we are like Odysseus. And that's exactly right. That's precisely the point that I'm trying to make. Yes?
I was going to say our environmental disenfranchisement is an image of that, too. For instance, it used to be that if they were going to make a decision about a national forest, people could talk up. They've just taken away that right. I don't know how many people of you know that, but they don't have public hearings now. No, they've just taken away the Northwest, the whole timber thing, that God squat. There is no ability anymore for the average citizen to speak out on that.
In addition, there's another parallel with that particular issue, which is a very important one. I told you that Tiresias told Odysseus in the darkness of Hades that the one thing that he must do is not to eat the holy cattle of the sun. Now, we all know that the rainforests are being destroyed at an incredible rate of thousands of acres an hour. For what purpose? Cattle. Mech cattle are grazing on the rainforest. And so the exact parallel is truly amazing, that the destruction of the environment is the eating of the holy cattle of Apollo. And by destroying the environment, what happened to the crewmen, by the way, the crew people, crew persons, all of whom were men in this pre-feminist epic, those who ate the holy cattle of Apollo were all destroyed in a great storm at sea. And in fact, the destruction of the rainforest may be the reason that we're having unusually powerful storms. I mean, the literality of some of these myths is really quite riveting. Other questions? Yes? Yes. That's exactly what it is. I think that's exactly what it is. There is the Vietnam, generation, which a large proportion of which is actually really homeless on the street. But then there is that part of us which is homeless, too, which has not been acknowledged by the larger society and so is homeless metaphorically. Now, in the Odyssey, what catalyzed Odysseus, because he was one person alone. How could he attack a house full of 100 knights, fully armed, all of whom would have been happy to have hacked him to pieces at the first opportunity? How could he possibly form together the concepts with which he could attack that situation? Just like the corporations now, just like if one of you were to go out and challenge IBM, I mean, not much of a chance, right? How could he possibly? What happened was he was sleeping at the house of his former swineherd, Eumaeus was his name, the swineherd, the loyal swineherd of Odysseus. And he was sleeping there. He had not declared himself. He was secret. He was incognito. And his son happened along, and he was disguised, and he declared himself to his son, in fact, by showing him a scar. You know, this is symbolically significant. By showing him his scar, he declared himself to his son. His son, who had hitherto been unformed and immature, suddenly said that in the presence of his father, the puer and senex merged. You see, the puer and senex merged. Odysseus and Telemachos merged into the unity of the two, which could overthrow the senex, which could overthrow. Isn't it amazing? I mean, these Greeks really did it right. I mean, these Greeks didn't have to have conferences like this. They just went to the theater. God damn. Huh? No, what he did, if you'd like to hear the story, it's really quite interesting, was he gains access to the house and he endures insults at their hands, like they say, oh, beggar, and they throw food at him and do all sorts of stuff, and he's very cool. And like Penelope has a dream, you know, the wife who they're all courting, has a dream. There's the bow of Odysseus, Odysseus's actual bow, which is still in the house, and nobody was strong enough to string the bow of Odysseus, that is to bend it and put string on it and actually shoot it, because he was a very big, strong guy. And so she has a dream that she is to choose one of the suitors. And the way she will choose him is which suitor is strong enough to string the bow of Odysseus. So she declares, these guys have been living in her house for 10 years. And he says, okay, I'm finally going to marry one of you. I will marry the one who is strong enough to string Odysseus's bow. So they all get together and they have a big party. And Telemachos, who at this point is still acting his role of the unformed youth, says, well, I'm expecting there'll be some trouble when we finally decide who the winner's going to be, so I'd like to pack all of your armor away in this closet so we can have a peaceful contest. So all of them, crazed by the greed that one of them, each of them thinking that he himself can do it, crazed by the greed of that they're going to get to actually marry, they give up their arms and it's all locked in the closet, and none of them can string the bow. And then they aren't strong enough. And then this old beggar who's been sitting around eating the dog food gets up and says, well, I'm the only one left. Let me try. And proceeds to shoot each one of them. Odysseus, like Telemachos and Eumaeus, bar the doors so they can't get out. They all cower in the corner because they're cowards. And he shoots them all one by one. And there's a whole chapter cleaning up the blood. All the nurses come out, the women of the household, the nurses who have been kept in bondage by these men, all come out and very happily clean up the blood. It's quite an interesting story. Aren't you glad you asked? Sir?
Perhaps to extend your analogy, I can think of a scenario that might, a fanciful scenario that might fit it, in that I think we would all agree that the government needs substantial downsizing. But the part of the government that is about to symbolically take that in the shorts is the military, which underlies our security. Recognizing that if the military votes as a block, say for a H. Russell Perot instead of a George Bush, that whole house of cards could come down substantially. That's the one place they could.
I would differ with you. It's a valid interpretation. I would differ with it. I would say that anyone who is on the ballot is one of the suitors.
That's possibly so. But the analogy.
No one's going to get on the ballot who isn't a suitor.
But the analogy there between the homeless and the military is that the military is actually a very small percentage of government expenditure. Mm-hmm. But they're taking symbolically the brunt of all of the people that do need to be downsized.
Well, yes, but yes, and certainly, I mean, how this is going to unfold, I don't know, and I don't even know if it's going to unfold. Remember, there is a big if. There is a big if, and that is the real question, and that is our real responsibility, because each of us in this room is part of this tragedy, and for it not to occur again, for us not to... By the way, the last war wasn't quite big enough. You know, I mean, not enough people quite got blown away for that one to work. So we're going to have another one, as we all know. And only when we recognize that this Odyssean allegory is happening in our midst, and only when we can inside ourselves have merged the Puer and the Senex into the new Odyssean consciousness, only then will the cycle be broken. And it's all ready to happen again. The aspects will repeat in 2021, and the thing can just go around again and again and again. This is what the Buddhists meant about the cycle of birth and death, is the hopeless repetition of the battle of the Puer and the Senex.
First of all, it's really great. I want to thank you. You're really blew my mind. It's kind of like reawakened my memory of that reading that book. If anybody reads that book, it's really difficult. But I was thinking, you know, it's really interesting if you can interpret this in so many different ways, and it's really, I think, my job. I love this idea of kind of interpreting the world. But it's interesting in the sense of just psychology, of how it all happens within that house, that it's contained. You know, this idea of the container, and that one can, like, go through the process within oneself and not have to, like, splash and go over the place.
You're mixing up myths. No, he simply strings the bow and starts slaughtering the suitors, just very unceremoniously. He's in a hurry.
What about the end?
No, that's when he carries the oar inland, is because the final thing he has to do after he's regained his kingship and all this is he has to carry his oar inland. And so that means that if, in fact, this transition is successfully negotiated, then the only way to keep the Senex from regaining power is to make something out of the transition, just as Homer wrote the Odyssey. And we have to write something. We have to create something and export it. We have to show other people and other parts of our own society. I mean, we have 15 countries, 13 of them are third world, right inside the United States at this point. We're so fragmented. And we have to take this concept and export it to those who do not know of it. And by sharing it with other people, it is thereby possible for us to continually renew our individuation. Jung said that you do not individuate, you must constantly purchase, ransom your individuation by giving values to the society of which you are a part. That you do not simply individuate and go live off on a tower and be really smart and wise and have people come and consult with you between 2 and 3 in the afternoon for high prices. No, you have to continually give back to society values in order that your individuation may proceed. And that is what I mean, that's what I believe in the epic, is the carrying of the oar. I think we're out of time. I'll be happy to answer further questions, but thank you very much. Wait a minute. I have a final quote from Jung, which I'll give you. And I think this has to do with battles and difficulties in the future. Man positively, I think he includes women here too, man positively needs general ideas and convictions that will give a meaning to his life and enable him to find a place for himself in the universe. He can stand the most incredible hardships when he is convinced that they make sense. He's crushed when, on top of his misfortunes, he has to admit that he is taking part in a tale told by an idiot. A man in the symbols.